Chapter 11. All-absorbing love. They took no heed of thickening mist, or of the breeze dying away before sunrise. They forgot the existence of the great forests surrounding them, of all the tropical nature awaiting the advent of the sun in a solemn and impressive silence. Over the low river mist hiding the boat with its freight of young passionate life and all forgetful happiness, the stars paled, and a silvery gray tint crept over the sky from the eastward. There was not a breath of wind, not a rustle of stirring leaf, not a splash of leaping fish, to disturb the serene repose of all living things on the banks of the great river. Earth, river, and sky were wrapped up in a deep sleep, from which it seemed there would be no waking. All the seething life and movement of tropical nature seemed concentrated in the ardent eyes, in the tumultuously beating hearts of the two beings drifting in the canoe, under the white canopy of mist, over the smooth surface of the river. Suddenly a great sheaf of yellow rays shot upwards from behind the black curtain of trees lining the banks of the Pantai. The stars went out. The little black clouds at the zenith glowed for a moment with crimson tints, and the thick mist, stirred by the gentle breeze, the sigh of waking nature, whirled round and broke into fantastically torn pieces, disclosing the wrinkled surface of the river sparkling in the broad light of day. Great flocks of white birds wheeled screaming above the swaying treetops. The sun had risen on the east coast. Dane was the first to return to the cares of everyday life. He rose and glanced rapidly up and down the river. His eye detected Babalatchi's boat astern, and another small black speck on the glittering water, which was Tamina's canoe. He moved cautiously forward, and, kneeling, took up a paddle. Nina at the stern took hers. They bent their bodies to the work, throwing up the water at every stroke, and the small craft went swiftly ahead, leaving a narrow wake fringed with a lace-like border of white and gleaming foam. Without turning his head, Dane spoke. "Somebody behind us, Nina. We must not let him gain. I think he is too far to recognize us." "Somebody before us also," panted out Nina, without ceasing to paddle. "I think I know," rejoined Dane. "He sun shines over there, but I fancy it is the girl Tamina. She comes down every morning to my brig, to sell cakes, stays often all day. It does not matter, steer more into the bank, we must get under the bushes. My canoe is hidden not far from here." As he spoke his eyes watched the broad-leaved nipas which they were brushing in their swift and silent course. "Look out, Nina," he said at last. "There, where the water palms end and the twigs hang down under the leaning tree. Steer for the big green branch." He stood up attentive, and the boat drifted slowly inshore, Nina guiding it by a gentle and skillful movement of her paddle. When near enough, Dane laid hold of the big branch, and leaning back shot the canoe under a low green archway of thickly matted creepers giving access to a miniature bay formed by the caving in of the bank during the last great flood. His own boat was there anchored by a stone, and he stepped into it, keeping his hand on the gunwale of Nina's canoe. In a moment the two little nutshells with their occupants floated quietly side by side, reflected by the black water in the dim light struggling through a high canopy of dense foliage, while above, away up in the broad day, flamed immense red blossoms sending down on their heads a shower of great new sparkling petals that descended rotating slowly in a continuous and perfumed stream, and over them, under them, in the sleeping water, all around them in a ring of luxuriant vegetation bathed in the warm air charged with strong and harsh perfumes, the intense work of tropical nature went on. Plants shooting upward, entwined, interlaced in inextricable confusion, climbing madly and brutally over each other in the terrible silence of a desperate struggle towards the life-giving sunshine above, as if struck with sudden horror at the seething mass of corruption below, at the death and decay from which they sprang. "We must part now," said Dane, after a long silence. "We must return at once, Nina. I will wait till the brig drifts down here, and she'll get on board then."
"And will you be long away, Dane?" asked Nina, in a low voice.
"Long!" exclaimed Dane. "Old a man willingly remain long in a dark place?
When I am not near you, Nina, I am like a man that is blind. What is life to me without light? Nina leaned over, and with a proud and happy smile took Dane's face between her hands, looking into his eyes with a fond yet questioning gaze. Apparently she found there the confirmation of the words just said, for a feeling of grateful security lightened for her the weight of sorrow at the hour of parting. She believed that he, the descendant of many great Rajas, the son of a great chief, the master of life and death, knew the sunshine of life only in her presence. An immense wave of gratitude and love welled forth out of her heart towards him. How could she make an outward and visible sign of all she felt for the man who had filled her heart with so much joy and so much pride? And in the great tumult of passion, like a flash of lightning came to her the reminiscence of that despised and almost forgotten civilization as he had only glanced at in her days of restraint, of sorrow, and of anger. In the cold ashes of that hateful and miserable past she would find the sign of love, the fitting expression of the boundless felicity of the present, the pledge of a bright and splendid future. She threw her arms around Dane's neck, and pressed her lips to his in a long and burning kiss. He closed his eyes, surprised and frightened at the storm raised in his breast by the strange, and to him hitherto unknown contact, and long after Nina had pushed her canoe into the river he remained motionless, without daring to open his eyes, afraid to lose the sensation of intoxicating delight he had tasted for the first time. Now he wanted but immortality, he thought, to be the equal of gods, and the creature that could open, so the gates of paradise must be his soon would be his forever. He opened his eyes in time to see through the archway of creepers the bows of his brig come slowly into view, as the vessel drifted past on its way down the river. He must go on board now, he thought, yet he was loath to leave the place where he had learned to know what happiness meant. I'm yet. Let them go, he muttered to himself, and he closed his eyes again under the red shower of scented petals, trying to recall the scene with all its delight and all its fear. He must have been able to join his brig in time, after all, and found much occupation outside, for it was in vain that Almayer looked for his friend's speedy return. The lower reach of the river, where he so often and so impatiently directed his eyes, remained deserted, save for the rapid flitting of some fishing canoe, but down the upper reaches came black clouds and heavy showers heralding the final setting in of the rainy season with its thunderstorms, and great floods making the river almost impossible of ascent for native canoes. Almayer, strolling along the muddy beach between his houses, watched uneasily the river rising inch by inch, creeping slowly nearer to the boats, now ready and hauled up in a row under the cover of dripping kajang mats. Fortune seemed to elude his grasp, and in his weary tramp backwards and forwards under the steady rain falling from the lowering sky, a sort of despairing indifference took possession of him. What did it matter? It was just his luck. Those two infernal savages, Lakamba and Dane, induced him, with their promises of help, to spend his last dollar in the fitting out of boats, and now one of them was gone somewhere, and the other shut up in his stockade would give no sign of life. No, not even the scoundrelly Babalatchi, thought Almayer, would show his face near him. Now they had sold him all the rice, brass gongs, and cloth necessary for his expedition. They had his very last coin, and did not care whether he went or stayed. And with a gesture of abandoned discouragement Almayer would climb up slowly to the veranda of his new house, to get out of the rain, and leaning on the front rail with his head sunk between his shoulders he would abandon himself to the current of bitter thoughts, oblivious of the flight of time and the pangs of hunger, deaf to the shrill cries of his wife calling him to the evening meal. When, roused from his sad meditations by the first roll of the evening thunderstorm, he stumbled slowly towards the glimmering light of his old house, his half-dead hope made his ears preternaturally acute to any sound on the river. Several nights in succession he had heard the splash of paddles, and had seen the indistinct form of a boat, but when hailing the shadowy apparition, his heart pounding with sudden hope of hearing Dane's voice. He was disappointed each time by the sulky answer conveying to him the intelligence that the Arabs were on the river, bound on a visit to the home-staying Lakamba. This caused him many sleepless nights, spent in speculating upon the kind of villainy those estimable personages were hatching now. At last, when all hope seemed dead, he was overjoyed on hearing Dane's voice. But Dane also appeared very anxious to see Lakamba, and Almayer felt uneasy owing to a deep and ineradicable distrust as to that ruler's disposition towards himself. Still, Dane had returned at last. Evidently he meant to keep to his bargain. Hope revived, and that night Almayer slept soundly, while Nina watched the angry river under the lash of the thunderstorm sweeping onward towards the sea. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.